He probably keeps his hat on.
There's a very colorful and questionable history of his family, particularly with his father.
I'll note for the record that we do have a member of the public who's joined us, who has an interest in the Atlantic County Sheriff's matter, so that we will, as a courtesy, take that out of order. So the next item and the first case for consideration will be item number 7, which is Atlantic County Sheriff's Office and PBA Local 243, docket number SN-2019-059. This draft grants the request of the employer to restrain binding arbitration over a grievance challenging the staffing levels of the criminal courts complex and the civil courts building. The matter of minimum staffing levels has long been established to be a non-mandatory subject for collective bargaining. While safety issues may be addressed in cases where staffing changes are not sought as a remedy, but where the single goal is to affect staffing levels, grievances have been consistently restrained from proceeding to arbitration. The PBA's claim that staffing levels are below an existing staffing plan does not convert the staffing issue to a mandatory subject. The staffing plan remains a managerial decision. I'll note that Commissioner Pero is recused in this matter in relation to the law firm that represents the PBA, so that we have a quorum of 4. May I have a motion to adopt the draft?
So moved.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion?
Yes, if I may.
You may.
Here we go again, and we've seen it with, at the federal level, the state level, with firefighters, and we've seen it with contract clauses, and since the day I've been sitting here, you know, a decade ago, we've had the same conversations about safety issues as they relate to minimum staffing. And safety issues are clearly negotiable, and safety issues are enforceable not only by this body, but by other bodies, such as federal statutes for the firefighters, such as OSHA compliance and everything else. So this is another one of those areas where it couldn't be any more clear that there was dialogue, there was agreement, there was a need, and there was an expressed acknowledgement on management's part that these issues related to minimum manpower in Cape May and Atlantic counties were an issue that was discussed, decided upon, and implemented in the contract clause. And now we find ourselves with management deciding that they're no longer going to honor that clause. And the argument is, erroneously, that staffing is managerial prerogative. Staffing is managerial prerogative, but safety issues are negotiable, and they're permissibly negotiable, and it was done. And so we find ourselves in that debate that we've had here a million times where, if I'm wrong, and I may be, because I don't have anything other than the materials supplied, there's a remedy. The management's right to staff that prerogative is preserved. And if they're wrong, and there is a safety issue, and there is a past practice, and there is a concern, that argument made in front of an arbitrator is the proper remedy. We're not usurping or eviscerating any of management's rights to minimum staffing. We're enforcing the contract clause, and we're enforcing those permissible safety arguments that this body has upheld in other issues in similar circumstances. I don't want to belabor the point, because it almost undermines me to discuss here what should be discussed in front of an arbitrator. If not, don't put the clause in there. Don't have the conversation in there. Don't acknowledge that sometimes it's an issue and then it's not an issue, because it is an issue from a safety standpoint.
Commissioner, I agree with you that this is a discussion and a debate that this body has had for many, many, many years, and it's come to the same result. It's a balance, and this body and the courts have found that unbalance, that the need for a remedy that affects staffing renders the grievance non-mandatory. And I'm not sure if the argument should be before the arbitrator or before the legislature, but I think that you've put your finger on the fact that it is a well-established and long-standing position of the commission and the courts that staffing on the balance is what governs the arbitrability of the issue. Whether there's other forum, might be another forum, I don't know, but in terms of what our role is in determining whether something is mandatorily or non-mandatorily negotiable and therefore arbitrable has been laid out before us in many, many, many cases. And I think you
recognize that. With the majority, vast majority of your observations, sir. All I'll say is that if you look at the petition filed by management and our reaction to that, we absolutely positively allow management to frame the issue instead of an arbitrator. And the references to this decision being within management's prerogative in establishing staffing is de minimis and not the argument. It's a contractual clause relating to safety. It's the argument that was permissible and it's included. And if we're just going to allow anyone, management or labor, to decide that they're allowed to frame the issue by virtue of the petition, then we don't need to be here. And that's what we did here. We allowed them to decide that that's what we're ruling on, and not with the actual argument, past practice, and contractual clauses. And with that, thank you.
Thank you for your input. They ask that all in favor of adopting the draft indicate their position. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
One recused, and the draft is adopted by a vote of 3-1 with one recusal.
Thank you.
Now let's return to the original order for processing. The next item is the City of Newark and Police SOA docket number CO-2020-063. This draft denies the city's motion for reconsideration of an interim relief decision regarding charges that the employer changed terms and conditions of employment relating to employee investigations and disciplinary review procedures during the negotiations for a successor agreement. The IR decision found a substantial likelihood for the charging party to prevail and the potential for irreparable harm. The draft we now consider asserts that the city failed to demonstrate the extraordinary circumstances necessary for reconsideration sought. Note that the draft reflects legal precedent that a federal consent decree entered into by an employer and not the union does not negate the employer's obligation to negotiate over mandatory terms and conditions of employment. I have a motion to adopt.
So moved.
Anybody second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
None opposed? The draft is adopted. The next item is State of New Jersey JJC and New Jersey Law Enforcement Commanding Officers Association, docket number SN-2018-046. This draft denies the employer's request to restrain the arbitration of a grievance concerning the placement of an employee in an employee relations group referenced in the contract with the corresponding salary increase. There is no preemption in this matter. The regulations relied upon by the employer do not expressly, specifically, and comprehensively preempt negotiations. The employer's defense that there was no promotion as addressed in the contract is a matter to be argued as a defense before the arbitrator. I have a motion to adopt. Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
None opposed? The draft is approved. The next matter is Pinelands Regional Board of Education and Education Association, docket number SN-2019-047. This draft grants the employer's request for the restraint of binding arbitration of a grievance challenging the withholding of an increment of a learning disabilities teacher consultant. The issue was strictly related to the proper form, strictly related to which is the proper forum for review. If the increment withholding were based predominantly on disciplinary reasons, it would be subject to grievance arbitration. As it was founded predominantly on matters of teaching performance, review properly lies with the Commissioner of Education. May I have a motion to adopt?
So moved.
Anybody second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Discussion?
I'm sorry, discussion.
I have one issue with this, and I'm going to refer to page 3. And I'm just going to read, because we know what the weight is here. It's discipline, it's here, if it's performance, it belongs where I'm eventually going to vote for it, because I believe it was inherently performance driven. But here's the language of the letter to the grievant. And the action was taken to withhold your increment due to your ineffective job performance and the concerns brought by numerous administrators. It is important for you to understand that we anticipate moving forward in a positive direction. And here's the key point. Please be aware, however, that in any future discipline issues could result in the board taking additional disciplinary measures, which may include tenure charges.
I would agree that there's no question that that letter was poorly drafted and did everything it could to undermine the employer's case in this matter, except there were no other facts to support that it was, in fact, discipline.
Which is why I'm voting in favor of this. Inflicted by the language, because we've had this discussion in the past.
It did make me look much closer at the facts of this case to make sure that, in fact, it wasn't discipline. But it's a point well taken that it had that appearance from a misdrafted letter.
I don't know that if there's any reason to enumerate that or just...
Given the weight of the evidence that it was related to teacher performance, I don't think that's necessary.
And that's why I'm voting in favor in spite of...
I noticed that too.
If the association appeals this in a statement or a brief to the appellate court, we can elaborate on that somewhat. I mean, any increment withholding penalizes slash disciplines a teacher, but that's big D discipline, but small D discipline, you know, what's the context of the particular dispute is sort of a different issue.
This discussion puts us in a position to acknowledge that we are totally aware of the writings.
All in favor of the draft?
Aye.
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 None opposed? The draft is adopted. But thank you for putting that point on the record. It's well taken. The next matter for determination is New Jersey Transit's Bus Operations Amalgamated Transit Union, docket number SN-2019-050. Deputy General Counsel Perez is recused on this matter. I just point that he's had no involvement in it.
As am I, because I did the interim relief decision.
Thank you. This is docket number SN-2019-050. The draft denies the employer's request for the restraint of binding arbitration of 5 grievances challenging separate disciplinary actions. All the grievances involved bus drivers who were discharged for alleged negligent operation of their vehicles. The employer unpersuasively urges a finding that the ATU's defense that the operator's view was obstructed by the design of the bus, that defense should render the grievance an incursion on management's prerogative regarding bus design. It simply presents an argument, we find that it simply presents an argument of mitigating factors for consideration by the arbitrator reviewing the disciplinary action, and it in no way is an incursion on the managerial prerogative regarding bus design. I do note that the standards in this decision are a little bit different due to statute, and that because it's New Jersey Transit Bus Operations, which had some unusual background in terms of the formation of their collective bargaining relationship, and that the negotiability standard is that it's negotiable unless it prevents the employer from its statutory mission. But I think our determination here would apply in under either standard. And we also found that there was absolutely no statutory preemption. I have a motion to adopt.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 None opposed, and the draft is adopted. Our last draft for the day is the Borough of Sayreville and Sayreville Association of Municipal Supervisors, docket number SN-2019-069. The employer's request for restraint of arbitration is granted in relation to a grievance claiming a contract violation for discontinuing health insurance opt-out payments for certain bargaining unit members. The employer relies on statutory authority that is express, specific, and comprehensive, establishing that the waiver and amount to be paid shall not be subject to the collective bargaining process. The statutory preemption speaks in the imperative. The Commission has held the statute in question to be preemptive and has restrained arbitration on that basis before. Here, the Borough exercised its non-negotiable discretion with respect to certain employees. They have a motion to adopt.
So moved.
They have a second. I will second the matter. Discussion.
If I may.
You may.
Generally, this is very similar to our earlier discussion. Generally, I concur with the superseding state statutes being the controlling issue. But we've had this in the past, and we're looking at it again. And council's been so kind as to print out a copy of the statute 4810.17.1. And here's my fundamental issue, my problem. The language that we use in the decision isn't necessarily mirror the language in the statute. And what we're dealing with is a clearly permissible benefit that, and I'm going to just read from some of the highlights of 4817. County municipal contracting unit employee permitted to waive health care coverage, notwithstanding the provisions of any other law to the contrary. And I'm going to get into an argument with that in a minute. What it says is that, and second line, if you enter into a contract providing health care benefits, and then there's some other language about the mechanisms, and it says, and I acknowledge that, that the amount is at the sole discretion of the county, municipality, or contracting, and then there's some ceilings plugged in. There's some controls. not to exceed 50%, 25% in this case, or $5,000, whichever is less, of the amount saved by the county or municipality because of the employee's waiver. So first, we're dealing with a statute that is preempted by other law, by its own first line title. Then we're talking about the purpose of this discussion is for collective bargaining agreements, is for CNAs and to enter into contracts. So there's got to be some application of contract law. And next, it says that they can set certain things, such as the $5,000, 25%, it's up to them, it's their sole discretion. We're not arguing that. Then it talks about the waiver. And it says the decision as a county, the decision to allow its employees to waive coverage, that in and of itself says that it's a permissible entry into a collective bargaining right or clause. I wouldn't call it a right, but it's certainly permissible. And it finishes, and this is the language that's a little bit different than what we finished with. The decision of a county, municipality, or contracting unit to allow its employees to waive coverage in the amount of consideration to be paid shall not be subject to the collective bargaining process. Now, I interpret that as the ceiling and floor and the right to enter into this allowed compensation. And it is compensation. And there's taxes on it, you got to pay this whole host of other rules that govern it, in addition to the other things in this clause, which have to do with IRAs and some other mechanisms that they can do. When we enter into contract negotiations and we have something that's worth $5,000 an employee, and there's only so many employees in this town, so it's not a de minimis number because it represents a measurable portion of the final agreement. We couldn't have an honest discussion without saying that the value of that benefit, that the value of that benefit is weighed against other give and takes, other negotiable concerns. So when these employees agree to this, knowing that they're going to get this, knowing that management at sole discretion permitted this, it becomes a value. In this particular case.
Just a second. Commissioner Bonanni, are you having difficulties?
Yeah.
Okay, but now you can hear?
I can.
Okay.
Not to reiterate, unless I'm being persuasive, the text of the statute, I refer to those things within the statute that would make our ruling improper, basically that it can't be contrary to withstanding laws, and in my opinion, existing contract laws, that while it's at the sole discretion of the employer, when the employer allows it to go in, it has a substantive value in the give and take in negotiations, and that past practices and the value of that has to be measured once it's entered into in the contract clause, and it can't just be deleted or taken away. The proper format for this resolution would have been to allow the contract to expire, then exercise its sole discretion, and at that point in time, it wouldn't become an issue of, with contract law, and, you know, I'm not the one with papers here, but I've done enough contracts to know there's two issues in contract law that have to do with void and voidable. The contract's not void because of this, but it's voidable, in so much as that it's changed the conditions, and hence, that contract, in theory, if you read the statute, that's ambiguous, and it's not counsel's fault, it's the way that it's written, the value of that contract that was negotiated in good faith, management could do this all the time, in other words, and then 15 minutes after the ink is dry, pull out a benefit that they're going to deem at their sole discretion. The benefit was plugged into the contract. The benefit has a reasonable weight against other benefits that they could have pursued and cost that management saved when you dollar cost out the value of this. All of that had to be weighed under 16G. So if their contract was statutorily compliant, let alone past practice, then that was waived. You've now taken something from somebody that goes back to the original language that says, then the contract becomes voidable. Well, we're not here to void contracts, so the proper remedy with this ambiguous statute would be to, at the expiration of the contract, allow the state, the employer to exercise its sole discretion, and then the employees group can weigh that against the other criteria in 16G when they negotiate.
Do you suggest that there's anything ambiguous about the phrase shall not be subject to the collective bargaining process?
Well, if you take those seven words, I get you. But if you take it in the line of the entire final line, the decision of the county, municipality, or contracting unit to allow its employees to waive.
And the amount of consideration.
And the amount of consideration is already earmarked. And we agree to that. It says what the ceiling is.
Can I just come in with a different concern, okay? You notice at the bottom of the page of 7, we have a PERC decision that says, while waiver payments were not negotiable, union could arbitrate to enforce annual waiver payment for a year in which waiver system was in effect. So that, why it would be a year as opposed to the length of the contract, strikes me as kind of strange. I'd say for the time in which the contract was in effect, that this says for the year or for the period in which the contract was in effect.
Well, can I just clarify something about the factual differences between that case and this case? Mm-hmm. In Orange Township, what happened was the employees decided to waive coverage completely, and then the employer decided to stop the waiver payment. So we had clear facts in that case. The employees had definitively given something up, right? That's different from this case. In this case, the borough's resolution, which changed the conditions under which employees could have a waiver, the employees who were impacted were employees who were getting their health insurance through someone else, through a dependent, through a parent, through a spouse. So they were still getting their insurance. What they lost was the payment itself. It's a financial issue, right? They didn't lose the insurance or make a decision to be uninsured through the borough, which is why this case, the facts of this case, are different than West Orange.
And the significance of the bond application
isn't any different.
Irrelevant.
The significance of the following year is that it that one would then not be involved in having made a choice, the employee making a choice, and then being denied the benefit of that choice because on January 1st it's a new benefit year. So that beginning with the beginning of the next benefit year, the employee would be armed with the knowledge of what the policy is and not be enticed into making a decision for which they would not reap the benefit. So that was the significant in the prior case and the application in this case of the fact that the date was January 1, the next January 1 after the adoption of the policy.
But here's how all of that not so much becomes irrelevant, but isn't the controlling argument. If I decide I'm going to get $5,000 and my wife, she gets insurance through, a deli that she works in, and it's Joe's bail bonds and health insurance. And it's the world's worst, thing. But my father's a doctor, my brother's a chiropractor, we never go to the doctor. I'd rather have the $5,000 and the crappy insurance. I've given up something for something. We don't know that either. We don't know if the value of the benefit that they were receiving is diminished as it relates to the healthcare plan that they had and its value, and the healthcare plan that they transferred, And that $5,000 wasn't a roll of the dice in that a diminished valued plan couldn't potentially gobble up that whole $5,000. And they were willing to do it, and they've got the right if management says, all right, we'll take waivers. Waivers, I've always had a problem with anyway, but that's a discussion for another day. But waivers were done to incentivize people. And the statute was put in to kind of alleviate this duplicity burden on management as to whether or not people are going to take it, not take it. It's a cost saver. It all has value, that's negotiable. And what it says is, in the very beginning of the statute, not contract to any other law. So the second that you remove the value of something that didn't have to be discussed, but that was willingly discussed in the contract, makes it a voidable contract, which means that they entered into a contract that isn't legal, which makes that a violation of superseding law. You can't do it. You can't have one set of rules with which we comply and agree to a certain standard and then diminish the value of that contract. And that's what we're doing by not letting this thing run out. This is, to me, just, you know, fundamental fairness, common sense. I have no problem with us saying, hey, you agreed to this, these people agreed to us, and its totality is in the value of the contract that you agreed with, so we can't void, nor does the statute allow us to void a contract. And the ceilings and floors and the permissibility of the sole discretion of the employer has all been honored as it relates to the very last part that the chair referenced, but that whole sentence has to be taken into the proper context. We can't allow people to change contract law.
I think you made a great argument for the legislature. And unfortunately, our job isn't to say what's fundamentally fair without consideration of what the statute says. And it couldn't be clearer to me that we have a history of applying a preemption standard and that preemption standard was met by this statute, and that whether we think it's fair or not, I don't think that we have a legal choice but to say that the preemption argument is valid. And
none of the aspects of the preemption argument are taking from management until they decide at their sole discretion, the language from the statute itself, at the sole discretion of management, they decide how they're going to handle it. So they exercise that. They had their ceiling and floors. They had their $5,000 rate. They had their 25% and 50%, depending on what sort of thing it is. All of those parameters and all of those non-negotiable items were recognized and honored and included in at management's sole discretion.
And arbitration, in order to enforce an element of that, is part of the collective negotiations process. Actually, it's just collective bargaining process for that.
Okay.
Right, it says the decision. The decision is part of the collective body of the units who allow. And that's what is not subject to collective bargaining. It says the decision, in other words, if you took out all the other nouns, and the only noun that is controlled by that verb and that adjective is the decision, shall not be subject to collective bargaining.
But it isn't the only one.
But that's the noun.
And arbitration is part of the collective bargaining process as well. I mean, the enforcement mechanism is part of collective bargaining.
But it's the decision that is controlled by a non-negotiable right. It is not the right to withdraw that decision or exercise their sole discretion.
And the amount, the decision and the amount. And none of it.
Well, nobody's arguing the amount. The amount is still
the bargaining process. Arbitration is part of
the isn't the amount and the decision both being honored by A, at their sole discretion they did it, and B, they set the $5,000? None of those things are being eviscerated or eliminated by the non-negotiability.
Okay. I'd like to go back to the facts and the case. Okay, I agree, by the way, it's a good argument for the legislature. I do agree that arbitration is part of the collective bargaining process. However, let's go back to the facts and the case, and maybe I misunderstood them. Okay, so in August of 2018, they had this waiver policy. Presumably, there wasn't an election. Okay, then in February 11th, 2019, they said the people who, you know, they'd already opted for their insurance on January 1st, 2019, retroactively. So they'd already made the decision per the other case. The employees had already made the decision, and then they withdrew the waiver. So I don't see, I understand the argument that people make these decisions for their benefit year, you know, based on the employer's promise of a waiver, which is an incentive to have insurance through your spouse rather than as in the other case. But I don't see that this is different because the board acted after the start of the year. The employees had made their decision based on the law, the earlier council's decision on August 18th. I'm on page 3 with the timeline, 3 and 4 with the timeline.
Yeah, 2, 3, and 4.
It's like they changed the rules of the game partially to the game.
Yeah, they did after, yeah, it was like a month and a half afterwards. In February, we moved it. I mean, I don't know if people got to go back and, you know, change their insurance decisions. Probably not. That way insurance works. So I don't see this as so distinct from the other case. Maybe it wasn't brought up.
The way that I was taught is contract law, and I'm going to defer to anybody here who knows more about it than me, but I've negotiated as many contracts as most of the people in this room. If government were to say, we want to buy a billion-dollar submarine, and they agree with Joe's submarine company to buy a billion-dollar submarine, and Joe's submarine company pays out $750 million in metal and whatever, you know, manpower and everything, and they build the submarine, then they deliver it. Government can't go back and say, we passed the law that all submarines will be 50 bucks. We can't change that contract. That's contract law. You can't plug something in to take away. Government can't indemnify itself in its responsibility to honor a contract that it entered into voluntarily. Without, there's nothing illegal in what they entered into. There's nothing illegal there. So there's no argument on government's side other than we're going to change the compensation, which is fine, and they can do it upon expiration. I don't understand how you could let them change the rate, the compensation, the value of the contract under 16G with everything that's been applied without saying it's either void or you have to wait for it to expire. Avoidable, not void, avoidable. Those are two different things too in contract law. I just wish that the decision said, upon expiration of this contract, everything that management, you know, wants to do is supported by the statutes, and that would be the decision.
Yeah, the difference in your example, Commissioner, is they sign a contract to build a submarine, and then they pass a law.
Right.
All right. Well, the Constitution says you can't pass a law that interferes with the obligations of an existing contract.
Can you speak up some, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry. You can't pass a law that interferes with the obligations of an existing contract. In this case, the law was passed in 2010,
right,
and the contract covers 2017 to 2022.
Right.
So here, the law was first, and then the contract, under your example, the contract was followed by the law.
Okay.
So that makes a difference.
Well, no, it doesn't. Because
but the contract is in place with the mayor, correct? And then the mayor and council also adopted the resolution. So the same person that is in under contract with the union is also creating a new rule, correct?
Well, yes, but the question in that type of situation is, what's the authority of the employer, given that the law is already in existence?
But if the language in the statute were any different, when I use the example of breaking a contract for anything, that's just so that we all concur with the opening statement that it has to be, notwithstanding the provisions of any other law to the contrary. I'm just using the example that I was taught of what a voidable contract is in government. That's an example of voidable contract. What the statute says is, at its sole discretion, it can enter into this contract. It did enter into the contract. It did get all of the benefits that are non-negotiable with the $5,000 maximum, with the, it's up to them whether or not they want to do it, and that was all preserved. It also did have to be in compliance with 16G. It had to be in compliance with Chapter 78. So the value was added into that. They didn't lose the two key elements of this, is that the decision to waive and the rates are non-negotiable, they're right, we're not arguing that, and that it's at their sole discretion to do it. Once they had all of their rights preserved and they entered into this freely at their sole discretion, they're creating a contract law issue that says you're changing the value of the contract. That's my point, and I understand what you're saying, that one is, you know, X, you know, and one is current. But it doesn't make a difference, because in the statute, halfway down, and I underline it, it says sole discretion of the employer. That's what's preserved by this. They changed the rules and the value of the contract. It makes it a voidable contract, which violates the very opening standard. And it kind of flies in the face of everything else that we do here, with changing the rules after you do a good faith exercise or something reached by an arbitrator, or however else we get to an agreement between management and labor. I don't want to belabor the point.
I have a question to ask, and Commissioner Vuz and Commissioner Ferrari both kind of hit on the fact that this this item was, or policy was passed in February, retroactive, I guess, to January 1 of 2019. Would your view of this be different if their ability to the ability to challenge the impact of the new policy were limited to the calendar year? I'm looking back at the Orange case. If it were limited to the calendar year in which the policy was implemented, which would then keep it in keep it consistent with the Orange case.
Yeah, it would change my view.
Ask for a motion to table the matter and see if we can present a draft, perhaps that can deal with that, and consider it in the January meeting.
Yes.
And again, I don't blame this body and all of the work that was done here. My problem is, you have to understand what the impact of this after the fact application is as it relates to the value of the contract. And that's why, if you want to make the point that we should consider going back a few months, I think it should be just the opposite. In 17, they signed this deal, they agreed to this, it should be in 22.
I understand your position, and I'm more concerned with the interaction with the Orange case, quite frankly.
I'll support a motion to table.
And I have a motion?
So move.
Second. Sorry. All in favor of tabling the matter for the next meeting? The
aye.
Next meeting?
Aye.
Aye.
The matter's tabled until the next meeting. Then the other item we have, yeah, is our meeting dates for 2019. For 2020. It's for 2020. For 2020. And I guess we need to, we need to publish this, as you know, that they're all, they are subject to change, but does anybody, at this point, is anybody aware of a problematic date?
I have a problem on March 26th. I don't know, is March 19th be possible? I just have a conflict that I have, unfortunately.
I am not available March 19th, I'm sorry to say.
That's probably better that I am gone than you are gone.
It's possibly debatable, but.
May 28th.
Why don't we publish the dates, and then we'll look at whether or not there's a way to change the March 26th date to accommodate you. We can discuss that in January.
Certainly, I'm still on the commission.
That they're subject to change.
November 12th, I will be gone potentially from the 3rd until, either the 3rd or 4th until the 10th or the 11th for our annual conference, so I won't have my documents unless there's a way I can get them through email and read them while I'm away. Is that possible? I don't come back until the 11th, so I would only have probably 12 hours to.
Right. We could certainly get you the decisions. It would be a little more problematic to get you all of the backup materials.
As long as I have the decisions, I could at least have something to be prepared.
When are you going away?
I'm either going to be leaving the 3rd or the 4th and coming back the 10th or the 11th.
We can try and get the backup materials out, perhaps, if those that we know.
For sure are going, yes.
At an expedited basis before you go away.
So you can
remind us.
Any pending cases can get pushed off to the following month.
Or if I have the decisions, I could always stop here the 11th when I get back in town to pick up the backup material.
The 11th is Veterans Day. The office may be closed.
Oh, you're right.
That's right.
And I'm taking that holiday too, aren't I?
Well, instead of sending them out the prior week, could you send them out that Tuesday or Wednesday, and then they would arrive at my house on the 10th or 11th?
Well,
I just don't want to sit outside for a week.
We will find a way to do it.
Yes.
Yeah. Just remind us in October.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a motion to adjourn.
A motion to adopt the dates.
Calendar.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A motion to adopt the calendar with the caveat of, potential dates may be rescheduled.
Yeah, they're subject to modification.
Subject to modification.
I have a second.
Second.
All in favor of the calendar?
Aye.
None opposed? I have a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Happy holidays, everyone.
You're adjourned.
Great one, best to your families, and thank you all for working.
Yeah, and.